Hey everybody, thanks for coming. Thanks for the Valley Stream Board for giving this this opportunity to reflect on climate change and our Buddhist practice. Diane Cassidy is joining, very kindly agreed to help out tonight. And she is also an activist. In addition to organizing SDC's Climate Sangha, she's also chief organizer of Third Act Sacramento, which is another climate advocacy organization. So each of us will talk about our journeys to advocacy and how it is that we relate our activism and our Buddhist practice. And after we speak, we thought it would be good to break into small groups and to give everyone an opportunity to kind of express themselves about how they feel about climate change and how it relates to their practice, if they see that it does. And then we'll come back together for to end up with sharing reflections. To start, let's look at a brief analysis of the global response to climate change. Anthony, could you show us that slide? Here we go. So Luann's husband, dad is saying last year's holiday cookies were memories of the year. Same this year? No. This year, it's signs we're making progress against climate warming. Oh, sounds ambitious. But it turns out the tray is empty. So Luann's mom was obviously reading the news. January 2024 was the hottest January ever recorded. The previous record was in 2020. And January was also the eighth straight month in which the month records was broken. As a result, those 12 months from February 23 to January 24 was the hottest 12-month period, the hottest year that's ever been recorded. And El Nino was part of the reason, but it was hotter than was predicted or expected by scientists. And the ocean was also hotter, very much. So the average temperature rise for those 12 months was 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. That's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, which happens to be the threshold that was established back in 2015 at the Paris conference, of the temperature rise that was to be, avoided because there was a threshold beyond which it was thought climate change would be unmanageable. Still, there is progress. The United States greenhouse gas emissions dropped last year despite a growing economy. At the Conference of the Parties last year, there was a global agreement to triple green energy output, to double conservation efforts, and finally, to phase out fossil fuels. And the U.S. is starting to hit its stride with large investments in green energy and greenhouse gas reduction, accelerated transition to EVs, and finally phasing, and many states are taking aggressive action. So a little personal history about how it is that I've come to find myself doing climate advocacy. Actually, I've always had kind of an environmental bent. I was a city kid. I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan. But I was drawn to nature, and I read books, collected insects, had praying mantis and black widow pets. When I was still in grade school, my grandparents moved to Long Island, to a place where there were woods, a bay, and the ocean. I explored, fished, clammed, crabbed. It was great. But the area built out, and the forest, the woods turned to houses and back lots. And I never expressed it, but I felt a deep regret about that. I went to high school, went to college, dropped out, was drafted, returned to New York. Camping alone off the Appalachian Trail on a small lake at dusk, I thought about nuclear power and the buildup of toxic wastes, which would be dangerous for thousands of years. And it felt so so irresponsible and dangerous to me that I thought I really had to do something about that. I didn't follow up that impulse, but it was my first calling to be an activist. Later in Vermont, I started reading about ecology. I was entranced by how incomprehensibly complex systems self-regulated. In California, I studied natural sciences at Monterey Peninsula College, deeply moved intellectually and spiritually by geochemical, biological cycles, the way DNA replicates itself, field studies. All of that was just so amazing to me, how intimately and precisely and elegantly nature has arranges itself. I worked on several campaigns there for nuclear power and to keep tankers out of Monterey Bay. I went to Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, and got a degree there. Went to work at the Association Monterey Bay Area Governments doing planning, water quality planning work. That led to a job in Sacramento at the State Water Board. Did a number of things there, ended my career managing the State Board's program for protecting wetlands and riparian areas. And I had a lovely retirement. I went camping and backpacking and climbing. And in 2016, after a presidential election, I felt I should get involved again. And climate change seemed the most urgent need. And I became involved with 350 Sacramento, an advocacy organization. There I work with climate action plans, local agency climate action plans. Currently, Sacramento County and the city of Rancho Cordova, with whom we're in litigation over their action plan. Climate change is an interesting challenge because it affects everyone, and no one is able to control it, but unlike birth and death, it's entirely in human hands. For me, activism is a way to claim agency in a situation that otherwise might become overwhelmingly dispiriting. Actions are the ground of my Buddhist practice, and practice informs my actions. I think it's probably that way for everyone. Seems to me that life is beautiful, but problematic. All day long, I'm seeking pleasant experiences and trying to avoid unpleasant experiences. It doesn't always work out. Climate change invokes unprecedented, unpleasant implications, including our imaginations about what the future might hold. But it's also true that at a personal level, life is always an unsolvable problem. There are difficulties, sickness, old age, death. Being born is hard, dying is hard. The period in between is often awkward. This is Buddha's immutable first truth. Still, climate change could cause enormous suffering. So we might ask, what's going to happen? How will it be for me? what's going to happen to the people and the things and the places that I love? For the moment, these are, in Krista Tippett's phrase, vast, open, aching questions. The answer is not discoverable by the discriminating mind. Our Zen ancestors said, not knowing is most intimate. The meaning is not in the words, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. Rilke said, have patience with everything that remains unsolved in your heart. Perhaps you will gradually, without even noticing it, find yourself experiencing the answer. For me, the koan is, how can I avoid attaching to my stories? My own stories. It's a useful koan, and climate change. My climate change work actually led me to it, or opened it to me. Sometimes I think that climate activism conflicts with other things they might be doing. Working with recalcitrant agencies, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time over a long period of time, and it can be aggravating. And I'm not young. This work seems important, but there's other things I'd like to do. And after all, what can I really achieve on climate change, working with local governments? I feel uncertain and conflicted sometimes. And I was thinking about this a while ago during a retreat. It penetrated my meditation and my practice responded. The sense of conflict that I was feeling really has no external basis. It's just a function of my ability to imagine some future possibility. And that's not a problem, but I make it a problem because I unconsciously invest in and attach to that imagination, my story. It's as if part of my brain that's in charge of deciding what's real takes its sensory inputs at face value. Seeing is believing, but imagining is believing too, at an unconscious level. Of course, consciously I know my imagination is not reality, but at a feeling level, that story in my mind is true. At that level, there are two realities, the actual one I'm living and the imagined future one. Psychologically, I'm split, and the result is I experience conflict and confusion. Actually, the reality is that in the present moment, I'm feeling conflicted because I am stuck in an imagined story about what I might do. It's not really a problem. I just haven't decided yet. Maybe I'll do something else, and maybe I won't. That's all. We'll see. Like anything involving people, climate work provides opportunities for right action, or not. It's a rich field because advocacy is by nature oppositional. And when I encounter what seems like an unwholesome opposition, sooner or later it comes to me that greed, hatred, and delusion are constants, and everyone has the potential for liberation. The paramitas are my go-to for how to act, particularly the first three, Dana, Sila, and Kshanti. Loving kindness is a lifesaver. I regularly think of the phrase we chanted tonight, let no one despise any being in any state. When I'm in the company of beings whose motivation seems to me ignoble, and they refresh that impression, I can experience antipathy. It's possible. At other times, I understand that my judgments and the objects of my judgments have no independent reality. And that reminds me, my feelings are unreliable and would be reproved by the wise. so I can let them go a little more easily. And finally, non-attachment to results. Our family way is to train in the impossible. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. All of them? Yes. In advocacy, I worry about what to do, but not so much about results. For instance, in 2011, Sacramento County promised, a legal promise, to adopt a climate action plan within 1 year. They still haven't done it. We started advocating in 2016, and there's been a lot of ups and downs. We're making headway now. But if I were attached to results during all that time, I don't think I could have stayed with it. So I feel fortunate in not taking those setbacks to heart. And if we succeed, there still will be problems. So thank you very much. I'll turn it over to Diana, and we'll take it from there.
Liberated. thank you for having me. It's really a delight to be here, as Sarah said. And Oscar, I practice Vipassana, or Insight Buddhism, with Sacramento Insight Meditation right here in this room on Thursday nights. But I have a tiny bit of exposure to Zen. When I was in my 30s, I lived up in the foothills outside of Nevada City, and there's a very small handmade Zendo. It's called Ring of Bone. And although I didn't practice there, they were very generous and had open houses for the community. And it was really lovely. I had such good feelings about the place. And then when I moved back to the Bay Area, I would go to Green Gulch once in a while and had the opportunity to spend a few days at Tassajara, and was just so impressed with the practice and the philosophy. And then I walked away. I started a career. I married. We had children. We were very busy with our lives. And it wasn't really until my 50s that I thought, maybe I should return to Buddhism. I think there's something there for me. So I wandered around a little bit, but landed with Sim. And it's just been a terrific experience. I've been sitting with him regularly for 6 or 7 years. Before I started with Sim, I did try to meditate on my own, and having a Sangha to practice with really, really made a difference for me. I think the triple treasures ring so true, that, you know, it's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are the treasures of Buddhism. So with that as background, I did become aware of the climate crisis, and I'll tell you a little bit about that, and then how Buddhism influences and supports me, actually, in my climate activist work. So as I was finishing my degree in public health, I was doing research on chronic disease, which was the leading cause of death in the United States, mostly heart disease and stroke and cancer, and felt like I had a pretty good grip on the influences of that and the fact that they were preventable. So people dying before the age of 65 was, you know, a tragedy that maybe we could do something about. And within a year of graduation, I read about a heat wave in the city of Chicago. This was in 1995. And people died during a heat wave. And I had never heard of anything like that after, you know, many years of study. And in fact, more than 700 people died over a 4-day heat wave. And I was so shocked, and even though it was outside of my field of research, I started reading everything I could about it. And in fact, it was literally the heat. And at least in my field, in public health, some of the more prescient writers were saying this is going to happen more and more. And I just couldn't believe it. I was stunned. And in fact, you know, throughout my career in public health, I would read the professional journals, and more research was published on the impact of the health impacts of climate change, until there were actually full issues of the American Journal of Public Health devoted to climate change. And, you know, and then there was the Paradise Fire and everything that's come after that, which you all well know. So I retired in 2020, and it was pretty clear that climate change was a big issue for me. You know, I had done some things personally to try to limit my carbon footprint. I became a vegetarian. I tried to buy most things secondhand when the time came and our heater and air conditioning, which was very old, finally gave out. You know, we got a heat pump, and which also is the same technology that's used by the water heater. So our house is primarily electric now. And because it's through SMUD, you know, all of that's fueled by renewable electricity. So that was, that felt really good. And yet, you know, we have the statistics that Oscar gave us that increasingly we're experiencing the hottest January, the hottest February, the hottest summer, you know, ever recorded. Just as an example, as part of my activist work, we're trying to convince a state assembly person down in Elk Grove to support some statewide climate legislation. And I looked up a heat map. It's an interactive web-based map that USC, University of Southern California, created. And from that map, I was able to tell the assembly member that her constituents, at least it's projected, that in 2035 and over the next 30 years, about a third of the year, the temperatures would be above 90 degrees. And for 40 days of the year, they would be above 100. So, we'll, you know, my initial fears way back in the last century about heat waves and its impact on health is and will become more so our reality. So I was in denial for a long time about climate change because it was just too horrible. It seemed too big. I couldn't do anything about it. The news coming out just became worse and worse. But a funny thing happened when I started practicing regularly with Sim. I felt like I could manage the bad news a little bit better. And that was because of my practice. I was extremely lucky to have the Sangha, and I engaged in some practices. Like I would just personally, I would devote a year to studying a particular topic in Buddhism. So for example, 1 year I chose the Brahma Viharas or the divine abodes, and the abode of equanimity very much appealed to me because I felt buffeted by whether it was interpersonal conflict or the bad news about climate change or you know, the decline in democracy and misinformation that we have in the United States. Equanimity really, really spoke to me, but so did the other Brahma Viharas. I mean, what could be better than sympathetic joy, you know, to rejoice in someone else's success or some very good news. So that was a teaching that really helped me. And another was, you know, this concept of impermanence. And I took a class that was a year long called A Year to Live. You might have, Diane Wild teaches it, but it's also taught in other places. And I learned the 5 daily recollections, which I could not say out loud when I was first introduced to it. But in summary, it says, you know, I cannot avoid aging. I cannot avoid illness. I cannot avoid death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. That's some pretty bad news. and yet, you know, faced head on with this very bad news, I felt like I could slowly let go. You know, that a lot of my misery was caused by clinging to you know, how cute my 4-year-old son was. You know, he's 32 now, and he is an amazing young person, or the camellia that's blooming in my yard. It will change and vanish. But in letting go of that, I can recognize that there are other items of beauty in the world. And so now my primary mode of climate activism is with Third Act, which is a group of people mostly over 60 who work to protect the environment and democracy. And people come to the group with a lot of reservations. They're depressed about climate change. Some will say right out, you know, it's too late, and yet they signed up. So I end up talking with them. And as Oscar said, you know, the Buddha encouraged us to engage in right action, not right results. And so that's what we do. You know, we try. We go to the Western States Petroleum Association, like I did today with 80 other people, and try to communicate with this lobbying organization that we don't need fossil fuels anymore. In fact, they're killing us and our children and our grandchildren. And, you know, maybe they didn't come out of their office and speak to us. Maybe they didn't quit their jobs, but they heard us because we were very loud and we said we'd be back. And so we need to keep on trying. You know, similarly, we're trying to get CalPERS, which is the biggest pension organization in the United States, to stop investing in ExxonMobil and the other fossil fuel companies. They have about $10 billion invested, which is only about 2% of their total investment fund. But they've been very hard to budge. And so today also, I was with a lot of people outside encouraging the CalPERS board to, you know, to divest. And maybe I'll be there next month, and maybe I'll be there next year, but I have to do it because it's, you know, the Buddha told us about right action. So the other, the last thing I want to mention is that there are many ways that Buddhism shores up my work and supports me. And it's not just in the Dharma or in the suttas, as we say. There are a number of American Buddhist teachers who are engaged in climate action and ways of thinking about Buddhism and how and why we should be involved. So David Loy is a Zen teacher who wrote the book called Echo Dharma. So clearly he's deeply involved in the topic. There's a group, just as a few examples, there's a group called Green Faith, which is an interdenominational, cross-denominational group where Catholics and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists write about why it's the right thing to do to engage in this climate work, even though it does seem sometimes overwhelming. And there are groups like Winter Sangha, which is actually an online international sangha that has a number of Buddhist teachers across the spectrum. And they have services on Sunday, and they have a number of all kinds of resources, talks and readings on their website. And so I'll end with a sort of a prayer that they have posted. And it's based on the work of Joanna Macy, which some of you may know, and her five vows from Work That Reconnects. And it's also published in her book called Active Hope. So this is the vow. Based on my love of the world and understanding of deep interdependence of all things, I vow to live in earth more lightly and less violently in the food, products, and energy I consume. I vow to commit myself daily to the healing of the world and the welfare of all beings, to discern and replace human systems of oppression and harm. I vow to invite personal discomfort as an opportunity to share in the challenge of our collective liberation. I vow to draw inspiration, strength, and guidance from the living earth, ancestors, and the future generations, as well as the siblings of all species. I vow to help others in their work for the world and to ask for help when I feel the need. And finally, I vow to pursue a daily spiritual practice that clarifies my mind, strengthens my heart, and supports me in observing these vows.
Small groups now. We've got some questions that I were suggesting that you consider. There are three questions. What feelings arise for you when you hear or read about climate change? Anxiety, disassociation, helplessness, sadness, anger, despair, so forth. Two, do you acknowledge and practice with these feelings? How? Well, and three, what would you like to happen? And is there anything you do or could do that might help? I'll hand these out to the groups. And Anthony will help us with the breakout groups on Zoom and send copies of these questions, I believe, to our online participants. So, let's take maybe 2-3 minutes apiece in small groups. Break up into groups of three, and one person speak for take turns speaking for a couple of minutes each. We'll ring a bell to time, and then a couple of minutes of just open conversation in the small group, and then we'll come back for a couple of minutes to review and answer any questions. Does that sound okay? Okay, let's go.
Yeah, and for everybody on Zoom, the questionnaire file is in the chat, so you can just download that, and then you can go into the breakout from there.
Well, it was really a treat to see all these groups, like, busily talking. Is there anything anyone would like to share from their groups or questions for Diane and I?
Oscar, they're still returning from the breakout. Probably about 30 seconds.
Right. So Anthony is telling us that he's bringing the breakout groups back in into the fold. Diana and I were talking about our respective experiences in groups and how people come. I really enjoyed hearing her talk about how people come to the group really kind of hesitantly and not knowing if there's anything they can do. And we share that there's so much power in coming together with others and doing whatever you can do, but doing it together. I mean, that's what Sangha's about too, right? How are we doing, Anthony?
They're back.
Oh, yes. Wonderful. Hi, people on Zoom. So if there are any thoughts that came from your discussions, we'd really love to hear them. And people on Zoom, please raise your hands too.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you. I was inspired by each of your personal stories and the devotion that you've had for maybe long, most of your lives to protect the environment and public health. And so that word, and it was also in our chant, just as a mother watches over, protects her only child. And so that was the word that was coming to me when it says, what would you like to happen? And what I shared with the group was, what I would like to happen is that all people would pay attention to their impulse, which I think is a very natural impulse, to protect everything, to protect life, to protect trees, to protect animals, to protect the atmosphere. And if, you know, so encouraging everyone to kind of really pay attention to their very natural impulse to protect, because the mother, at the risk of her life, protects. I mean, and without thought, without question, without any second guessing at all, it just naturally wants to do that, just to protect. And I think if everyone paid attention, that's what I want to happen. I want everyone to pay attention to protecting beings of all stripes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Now, maybe I would just add to that. It seems like it would be fairly easy because most people don't like change. And but it doesn't, maybe a lot of money, like, I mean, they like money better than they resist change. I don't know. Anyway, and I also think both of you, I didn't catch, by the way, the name of the organization you mentioned, Diana. Can you say that?
Third Act.
Oh, and that was the one that had the website that had...
That's One Earth Sangha.
Wonder?
One Earth.
Oh, One
Earth. Sangha.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
It's
Thank
wonderful.
You. Thank you.
So in our group, you know, Jim had shared with us about the impulse, the natural impulse to protect, and I was really listening to that to see if that resonated with me, and it does. And I think about what is it in our society today when we talk about activism and really trying to get a message across that prevents people from being able to act on the impulse. And I think Karen touched on it when you were saying, you know, people like maybe money more than resist change. I think with the way our society is set up, if you want to, you can be hyper-scheduled and overbooked. I know that I fall prey to that a lot, thinking that I'm adding quality to my life, and I enjoy my life. But if I'm constantly in a state of being busy, my nervous system may not be available to act on that impulse. I might even miss it, right? And so I think being here in Sangha tonight, being able to slow down and to talk with each other in small groups and a really supportive environment where we can inspire each other, that can help foster that availability to that impulse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Andrea. That was our thought too when we decided to have small groups, because I think there's a lot of anxiety about climate change that is not expressed. People are reluctant to talk about it. It's kind of like, oh, don't talk about that, you know, unpleasant. But there's a lot of power in expressing how you feel and with others. But we have a tremendous job, you know. Change is difficult, and we're not, I mean, even at a personal level, you know, we study for years trying to affect some obvious changes that need to happen. And at a societal level, we're deeply invested in the status quo in terms of how we get our energy and how we direct our wealth. So, climate change is like a warning bell, you know, the whole schmear that, you know, has not been working. So what are you going to do? And we're trying to figure it out. Anything else?
Well, what you just said, Oscar, actually resonated with me for a moment. It's like, well, what are you going to do? you know, we're trying to figure it out. Well, some of the things Jeremiah was saying, we do know what we need to do. It's not figuring out what to do. It's how we change our behavior and the attachment that we have to the status quo and to the things that are comfort, the things that we think make us happy. So to me, that's a fundamental Buddhist teaching right there, right? Is that clinging. That's the problem.
Yes, and in my view, what we're clinging to, the most difficult thing is our own stories about reality, which are not actually true, but we're so hardwired to make stories and to believe them, rather than realizing that this present moment is the only reality. And it's great to be able to plan and remember, but that's not what's real. So it's a change, a deeply psychological change too, to facilitate the economic, technical change that we need to make. And it's not so clear how to do that. But we're trying, right? Larry.
I had a thought. I mean, it's good that we take ownership of ourselves and our actions, our thoughts, and, you know, have the intention to be of benefit. And so, you know, people will say, well, what are the little things I can do? But in terms of these feelings that were expressed, at least in my little circle, of, you know, helplessness. I heard, and this is really my question for the two of you, I heard that, for instance, let's use water. You know, we had so many substantial droughts, maybe not right now, but where we were asked, there was periods of time, where they restricted the watering of the lawn, and ask people to, you know, conserve water. And then I also heard, you know what, you as an individual human being, even though you want to do good, how much water you drink out of your faucet in a single day is of, in truth, of such little consequence compared to the water used in huge agricultural ventures. And then you can take that concept and put it for other, you know, little categories of environmental concerns. So really, when we want to talk about effectuating, you know, real effectuating change, is it our little actions that really make that much, or do they make us feel like we're playing a part? I mean, or is it the giant institutional people that where change needs to happen? So I'm just curious, from, you know, you have more knowledge than I do, what you think.
I'll take a shot at it. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Larry. It's a complex question. But there's no doubt in my mind, and Diana was protesting today before the Western States Petroleum Association, that we need change at, for instance, the county level and the federal government level and the global international level. That's, you know, we have to have that. On the other hand, at a personal level, maybe it doesn't matter that much that how I water my, you know, that I use drip irrigation. Maybe it doesn't matter that much, but I can do it. So I do it. It doesn't stop me from protesting or commenting or trying to influence, advocate at every level I have access to. But I have a personal stake. I have, you know, I can talk about this because I try to live that, and I so, but there's been a lot of effort on the part of like corporations and institutions to put that that responsibility on the individual. Oh, you should recycle plastics. You know, that's what we need. It's not up to us to stop churning out plastics. You should recycle. But it's all part of one system. You know, everything is working together. So if you take one step, you know, the world changes.
You know, I agree with you. I do what I can. But I guess my conclusion from that real difficult issue is I do what I can, and I don't suffer deep anxiety from my sense of helplessness and that there's only limited things. So maybe for people who, maybe it's a way to deal with, you know, people who have that real sense of anxiety from it is do what you can, and you know the rest. You know, you can't let yourself suffer.
There's no need to suffer unnecessarily.
Yeah.
Do what you can, and what can you do?
Right.
That's the question. Can you recycle your glassware, or can you write a letter to your congressperson, or can you, you know, can you go testify and really do what you can? And part of what you can do is find out what you can do. And one way to do that is hook up with other people who have been asking that question for a while and have some answers. But the important thing is to do something. And as much as you feel is needed. Well, if there's nothing else, I think maybe it's time to close. Thank you, Sarah. We'll close with our usual closing chant.
May our attention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Karma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.